We'd like to commence our final session as soon as we possibly can, so we would encourage you strongly to take your seats and we'll get this underway. I think I'll chatter for a minute while people are walking in. We still have about 50 plates untaken for the dinner tonight, and we've decided that since we've already paid for them and they have already essentially been prepared, that we would rather have them used than to have them wasted. So what we would propose is that any of you that have not signed up for the dinner because of the cost prohibition, that you take a ticket anyway and give what you can. And this is unfair, totally unfair to all of those who have paid $8.50, and I admit it's unfair and we are very sorry, but I would rather not waste those meals. We could take the New Testament example of the fact that those invited did not come, and therefore we go into the streets and drag those in who didn't want to go, but we don't even have time to do that, and if we did, we would, I think, knowing us. So we invite you who are here to take advantage of the dinner and compensate however you feel, and it would be fine. Also, those who, some people said, well, can I just come and sit there and listen and not even have the dinner? Can I come late, and am I excluded because I didn't pay for dinner? No, you're all invited to participate. I think the occasion of finding out about ourselves through the eyes of others is valuable, and we certainly don't want to discourage you from coming because you don't want to share dinner with us. We understand some people are more social than others. Since this is the last formal session here, would like to again express our thanks to the university for providing this facility. Special thanks to the Utah Endowment for the Humanities for providing funding to allow us to have this symposium. We also would thank all of you who have patronized us through registrations and purchasing magazines, etc. All of this helps a great deal. As you may know, Sunstone is a nonprofit corporation and very happily and receives donations from those who need philanthropic options. Some of you have done that, and we appreciate it very much. We actually need that to keep going, and it's sometimes a struggle. With that introduction, and some of more have come in, I'd now like to introduce our speakers. Stephen J. Stein is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Indiana University at Bloomington. He received his PhD in Religious Studies from Yale University. We're very, very gratified to have him here today, particularly considering the recent events regarding a tragic death in his family, and we're very thankful that he was able to come back and deliver this paper as promised. His title will be Signs of the Times, the Theological Functions of the Early Mormon Apocalyptic. Responding to Dr. Stein's paper will be Gene Campbell, familiar to most of you as historian, teaching at BYU, author of one of the 16 volumes of church history that may someday see the light of day. His volume pertains to the early pioneer period, the Brigham Young years, and we're very grateful to have his response. So we'll now hear from Dr. Stein, then the response, and if we have any opportunity, which we may or may not have, we'll possibly have questions.
I would like to take a chance to thank the staff of this program for rearranging the schedule in such a way as to make it possible for me to be here. I'm grateful for that opportunity, and I apologize to those who might have been inconvenienced by that change. I also have new admiration for the Latter-day Saints. I want you to know that in the community of which I'm a part, the hour from 5 to 6 is reserved for happy hour, not for theological discussion. In the inaugural issue of the Evening and the Morning Star, published in 1832 at Independence, Missouri, William W. Phelps, the editor of that first Mormon periodical, stated the objectives of the new publication. The Star, he wrote, was to serve as the friend of man in these last days, to persuade those who read it that they must turn to God and live before the great and terrible day of the Lord. The Star comes, he announced, as the messenger of truth, to prepare the way of the Lord, bringing glad tidings to the house of Israel and warning all nations of the impending days of tribulation. Phelps struck an urgent apocalyptic note in his prospectus, but he was doing little more than echoing words ascribed by Joseph Smith to the prophet Nephi in the Book of Mormon, words which foretold that the ancient prophecies of Nephi would likewise be of great worth in the last days when evil and unbelief abound. The apocalyptic theme sounded in 1830 in the Book of Mormon and again in 1832 in the Evening and the Morning Star was amplified and extended during the following years. Eventually, that theme became a standard part of 19th century Mormon theology. It is my intention this afternoon to explore with you the character of early Mormon apocalyptic reflection as articulated in the Evening and the Morning Star and the larger tradition of which it was a part, and to examine the theological functions of this kind of religious thought during the opening years of the LDS movement. In one form or another, apocalyptic, which means an unveiling or revelation, and which commonly refers to literature purporting to unveil the things of the future, in one form or another, apocalyptic has remained a significant part of the theological legacy of the Latter-day Saints, even though, as a consequence of historical change, only in a muted version. The mainstreaming of Mormonism in the 20th century and its slide away from sectarian principles has softened and altered its eschatological proclamation. This change raises an intriguing question. Does the loss or the blunting of a radical apocalyptic edge come as an advantage or as a disadvantage for a religious community whose self-identification for a century and a half has been as the Latter-day Saint? No group of Mormons, especially not an assembly gathered together in Salt Lake City, the Mecca of the faith, needs to be reminded by an historian, and a Gentile at that, that they are heirs of a theological tradition that has been preoccupied with matters of eschatology. Eschatology, that long word, as you know, is the category used by theologians to refer to the religious concerns dealing with the last things, those things that relate to the end of an individual, or of all mankind, or of the world. Mormonism is inescapably eschatological and apocalyptic. Article 10 in the Articles of Faith, written in the early 1840s, declares, "We believe in the literal gathering of Israel, and in the restoration of the 10 tribes, that Zion will be built upon this continent, that Christ will reign personally upon the earth, and that the earth will be renewed and receive its paradisical glory." Article 10 reflects the early apocalyptic interests of the first Mormons. The most recent statement concerning the importance of eschatology for the founding generation appears in the volume published in 1979 by Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten. In the second chapter of the Mormon Experience, which describes various reasons for the initial success of the church, the authors note that in the first years of the movement, the theological appeal of Mormonism was not limited to, quote, its doctrines of God, man, and salvation. These were, they write, frequently overshadowed, especially during the 1830s, by millenarian and eschatological claims regarding the end of the world and the second coming of Christ. Despite the acknowledged centrality of apocalyptic and early Mormonism, relatively little attention has been paid to this dimension of the LDS tradition. I do not mean to ignore the contributions of Klaus Hansen and others, but they have concentrated upon later periods. The lack of attention, I think, rather reflects the disfavor our culture has generally shown until recently toward the subject of eschatology and towards traditional apocalyptic speculation in particular. For many persons living in the late 19th and 20th centuries, these topics have been embarrassing. The embarrassment, however, is not associated with any specific religious tradition or viewpoint. It is more inclusive. The prevailing negative perspective on these matters was given classic expression in the second decade of the 20th century when Walter Rauschenbusch, a prominent theologian and spokesman for the Protestant social gospel, wrote as follows: "The study of traditional eschatology," and I'm now quoting, "is usually loved in inverse proportion to the square of the mental diameter of those who do the loving." This stigma has been slow to leave apocalyptic discourse, a theological area seemingly reserved for those with limited capacities, wild imaginations, or unduly dour outlooks. But eschatology and apocalyptic cannot be reserved or declared off-limits theologically. A new generation of historians has shown the formative role played in American religion by these issues. Even Walter Rauschenbusch acknowledged the same in 1917 when he wrote, "Religion is always eschatological. It lives in and for the future. In religion, we seek for the final realities, the absolute values, the things as God sees them." He continued, "All religions of higher development have some mythology about the future. The Christian religion needs a Christian eschatology." The first task of this essay, therefore, is historical recovery. Recovery of a recognition of the centrality of the apocalyptic message in early Mormonism. The Evening in the Morning Star provides an excellent point of departure for pursuing this first objective. In my presentation, I am featuring this periodical for several reasons. First, I find that surprisingly little use has been made of it by historians. Furthermore, the Star is a rich source of information concerning the theological character of early Mormonism. Also, it was published during a time of crucial transition for the young church. And finally, in a symposium sponsored by an up-and-coming Mormon publication, it seems fitting to examine one of its predecessors. The Evening in the Morning Star had an unusual publication history. The first issue appeared in June 1832 as a monthly. It was composed of four large sheets or eight pages. The cost for a subscription was $1 for a year in advance. The publication served the cause of the infant church by spreading news of its expansion, by printing the new revelations that came to Joseph Smith, and by defending Mormon theological views. Missionaries also used the paper as a tool in their efforts to gain converts. William Phelps became the first editor of the Star as a result of revelations announced to him by the prophet in June and July of 1831. According to Smith, it was God's will that Phelps be planted in Jackson County, Missouri, and that he be established as a printer unto the church. Unfortunately, not everyone, including Smith, was pleased with either Phelps or his publication. In August of the same year, Smith rebuked him for not being sufficiently meek before God. God was displeased with Phelps, the prophet said, because he had sought to excel, perhaps a reference to some form of personal ambition. Repentance was the prescribed remedy. Later, Smith expressed disappointment also with the publication. After several issues had appeared, he wrote to Phelps, "We wish you to render the Star as interesting as possible by setting forth the rise, progress, and faith of the church, as well as the doctrine. For For if you do not render it more interesting than at present, it will fail, and the church suffer a great loss thereby. The Star, in fact, was typical of religious periodicals of the day. 14 issues of the Star appeared before violence interrupted publication in the summer of 1833. On July 29, it was reported a mob of 400 or 500 persons gathered at Independence and, quote, proceeded to demolish or raze to the ground the printing office and dwelling house of W.W. Phelps. The press was broken, the type pied, and other equipment destroyed. It was December before publication was able to resume, this time from Kirtland, Ohio, and under the editorship of Oliver Cowdery, who earlier, with Phelps, had been ordained a steward of the revelations and commandments of God and editor for the church. Cowdery, you will recall, in 1829 had shared with Smith the restoration of the priesthood of Aaron and had been declared one of the two first elders in the church. Under Cowdery's editorship, the Star appeared for 10 more issues. He maintained the size but altered the format and the content somewhat, intensifying the apocalyptic motif. His opening statement to the subscribers set the tone. He wrote, "Wars and rumors of wars are spreading over the world, nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, calamity upon calamity, and pestilence following plague, iniquity abounding and the love of many waxing cold, almost every man seeking his own interest in the destruction of his neighbor, and the hearts of this generation so grossly hardened that no man can trust even his brother. And more than all these, that great day fast approaching, when this scene of wickedness shall close, the veil of eternity must be rent, and the Son of God be seen coming in the clouds of heaven with all his holy angels with power and great glory." In the same issue, Cowdery included a song for Zion with the following stanza. "Oh, that the day would hasten on when wickedness shall all be gone and saints and angels join in one to praise the man of holiness." The Evening and the Morning Star ceased publication abruptly after the September 1834 issue. Cowdery closed that last issue with a reflection concerning the calamities of his day, ending with this exhortation, "Let us be ready, for his coming is near." The point is that for more than 2 years in the early life of the church, from 1832 to 1834, the Star proclaimed an apocalyptic message to its readers. William Phelps declared that the publication was a harbinger of both good and evil, peace and goodwill to the saints and potential calamity to those pursuing vain religion. "The Star," he wrote, "is devoted to the great concerns of eternal things and to the gathering of the saints. The ultimate hope of the inhabitants of Zion is that they will rise and reign with Christ 1,000 years on the earth." At the beginning of the second year of publication, Phelps reminded his readers that the principal purpose of the periodical was that the world may know of the judgments to come. In the same breath, he warned, "The time has arrived when them that mean to be saved must save themselves." Oliver Cowdery persisted with this apocalyptic proclamation when he took over as editor. He filled 2 pages of his first issue with an article entitled "Signs of the Heavens" and with the first installment of a long, rambling essay on the millennium. Long essays became increasingly common during his period. Cowdery closed the same issue with an editorial postscript to the subscribers, requesting information about the successes of the church in various quarters because, he noted, "the Star is designed as an engine of truth to spread the light among mankind." Under the direction of Phelps and Cowdery alike, the Evening and the Morning Star cultivated an interest in apocalyptic discourse among the early Mormons. It featured certain topics of traditional concern. Notable among these were 3: identification and interpretation of the signs of the times, reflection about the conversion of the Jews, and speculation concerning the time, nature, and location of the millennial age. The second task of this essay is historical description. description of the character of these featured items and placement of them within a proper historical context. Among the issues of traditional apocalyptic concern featured by the star, there was no more persistent theme sounded than that of the abundance of the signs of the times. Observing signs was an ancient apocalyptic practice whereby one determined the contemporary position of the world on the divine timetable. Observing signs filled the hours of those who waited for a reversal of fortunes or for a vindication of their cause. The editors of the Star regarded such observation as their responsibility. Quote, "Our readers will expect from us some of the signs of the times," wrote Phelps in October 1832. "And as watchmen that would strive to be approved in all things before the Lord, we will try to collect a few of the many and lay them before the world." In May 1833, he wrote, "It is no more than will be expected of us to note the passing tidings, signs, and wonders of the day. The world is full of strange appearances, and all eyes are once in a while turned towards the coming events of the day to catch a glimpse of what may be expected." Any event could be declared a sign, but normally signs were manifestations of a very unusual sort, something extraordinary, working good or evil. In 1833, the Star contained the following representative list of signs of the times, and I'm quoting, "The cholera spreading over the whole earth, the plague breaking out in India, the revolutions in Europe, the dissolution of South Carolina from the Union, the gathering of the saints to Zion, and the assembling of the Jews at Jerusalem." To the uninitiated, these were simply events on the unending calendar of days. For believers, however, these events became integrated parts of the divine plan for the ages. Interpretation of the signs of the times was an art or a skill reserved for the saints. To those, quote, "without the true knowledge of God," Phelps wrote, "world events are incomprehensible. The faithful, however, are able to understand and discern fuller meaning in such affairs. Dreadful occurrences, for example, produce confusion and bewilderment in those who do not believe. They provoke shouts and curses of anger. But the saints recognize that the wrath of God is sometimes poured out on the age in order, quote, to convince every man in the world that the end is near, that the harvest is ripe, and that the angels are reaping down the earth. By this means, the faithful are also encouraged to persevere in the face of hardship and suffering." The most striking effect of the preoccupation of the early Mormons with the signs of the times was the emergence of a firm conviction that they were living in the last days, the moments immediately preceding the climax of history. One example makes the point. 1832 was the year of the nullification crisis in the United States, a controversy in which South Carolina tried to measure its independence against the notion of a federal union of states. The Star followed that struggle closely, under the assumption that this political conflict was another sign that the world stood on the threshold of the last days. In January 1833, Phelps inserted a two-paragraph notice of developments. In March, the Star used nearly a full page to discuss the unhappy crisis with its melancholy prospects for Republican government. The struggle augurs the near approach of the day of the Lord, wrote the editor, a day that will bring terror to the hearts of unbelievers and conflict and warfare, destruction and bloodshed to the world. Though the United States may break apart over this issue of nullification, the kingdom of God will prevail, said the editor. The Star concluded, men are agents unto themselves, and they can prepare for a kingdom of glory or for one without glory. The language of the Savior is, and I'm still quoting, "The Spirit and the Bride say, Come, and let him that heareth say, Come, for the hour of redemption is nigh." The early Mormons were drawn naturally to reflect upon the signs of the times. In 1831, the prophet had disclosed a series of revelations dealing with the signs that would precede the gathering of Zion in the western lands and the establishment of the New Jerusalem. Smith had also assured the elders sent on missionary journeys that they would see many signs and wonders. But perhaps the prominence accorded eschatology in early Mormonism is even more a product of the fact that the evening and the morning star appeared at a time when America was charged with an apocalyptic fervor that had been building for two centuries. New England in particular, from which so many early Mormon leaders hailed, had a long and rich tradition of eschatological speculation. The foremost minister of the founding generation of the American Puritans, John Cotton, was renowned for his sermons on the Book of Revelation. But that fervor and that interest did not subside with the passing of the founders. Three generations of prominent Puritan divines in the Mather family, Richard, Increase, and Cotton, maintained that strong commitment to apocalyptic thought, but each adapted it to his own time and place. Even in the 18th century, when Puritanism gave way to the new religious impulses associated with the rise of evangelicalism and with influences stemming from the Enlightenment, the preoccupation with apocalyptic remained. An outpouring of speculation accompanied the religious revivals which spread throughout the colonies in the 1740s, during the period known as the Great Awakening. Large numbers were converted to an evangelical form of Christianity, which focused upon the experience of grace. The most prominent theological figure to emerge from the 1740s was Jonathan Edwards, who defended the revivals as the work of God and who served as the architect for the last systematic defense of conservative Calvinism. Philosopher-theologian that he was also driven by an apocalyptic fixation. Edwards kept a special notebook devoted exclusively to commentary on the Book of Revelation. In it, he reserved a section for signs of the times. His was a double-entry form of observation. He kept one list entitled Events Fulfilling the Sixth Vial, referring to Revelation 16:12, in which he recorded disasters inflicted upon Roman Catholic nations as reported in the newspapers. Into another list entitled Events of an Hopeful Aspect on the State of Religion, he placed accounts of the spread of evangelical Christianity throughout the world. Edwards was not alone in his interest in the signs, nor in his conviction that the day was late. His grandson, Timothy Dwight, for example, voiced the same warning in 1813. There is a crisis in all human events. If seized, it almost ensures success. If lost, he wrote, everything is lost with it. Many in both the 18th and the 19th centuries were ready to join in the cry, the hour of redemption is nigh. But how near was the end in the eyes of that first generation of Mormons? Joseph Smith was very cautious about engaging in the tricky business of apocalyptic arithmetic. But that does not mean either he or his contemporaries were uninterested in such matters. The early Mormons showed their interest in a divine timetable by their concern with another apocalyptic issue, the question of the conversion of the Jews. It was a time-honored view that the conversion of the Jews to Christianity would occur shortly before the end time. The Mormons accepted that view. But the precise time, wrote an observer in the Star, and the way and the manner in which this will be effected, the Lord has reserved to himself. Nevertheless, the apocalyptically minded looked for potential associations with that future event. On one occasion, the editor of the Star described the migration of scattered Jews to Palestine, placing their move in the framework of the latter days. He went on to discuss Joseph Smith's idea that there would be two places of gathering in those days, Jerusalem for the Jews and Zion in the American West for the Gentiles. In the Star, the primary focus remained on the former gathering. Accordingly, all news about the Jews was eagerly received. The Star featured, for example, a report of famine in Palestine, a notice of Polish Jews planning to visit Jerusalem, and an extended discussion of the prophecy of Zephaniah concerning the restoration of the Israelites. The conversion of the Jews was a concern not only because it signaled entrance into the penultimate stage of history, but also because it confirmed for the Latter-day Saints the truth of their new scriptures. According to the Book of Mormon, Jesus explicitly prophesied that when the fullness of the gospel comes, the Jews will acknowledge him as Christ, the Son of God. The link in the Book of Mormon between ancient Israel and the inhabitants of the Americas gave additional grounds for concern. In working out a relationship with the Indians in the West, the Mormons were contributing to the latter-day process of the conversion of Israel. Under the editorship of Phelps, the Star printed a variety of accounts telling of Indian life and activities. The conversion of the Jews also had a bearing upon the self-conception of the early Mormons. In some sense, the fate of the Jews was an anticipation of their own final destiny as a religious community. To the Mormon way of thinking, the parallels between the two were numerous. Both were a chosen people. Both had experienced hardship. Redemption came for both through a prophet selected by God. To that prophet and his people, God revealed a new law with covenant obligations. Ancient Israel and the Mormons alike were tested sorely in their wanderings before full salvation was brought to pass. Both looked toward a promised land where they might dwell in peace and unity and become a redeeming influence upon the nations. Again, multiple forces were at work cultivating the interest in the conversion of the Jews among the early Mormons. The prophet's revelations concerning eschatological matters had included a description of the change of heart which would occur among the Jews at the time of the first resurrection. There also existed a rich tradition of American speculation about the conversion of the Jews and its place in the plan of God. John Cotton, in that first colonial generation, believed that the conversion of the Jews would accompany the pouring of the sixth vial. Increase Mather, who served for some years as the president of Harvard College, thought that the conversion was underway in his own times. He cited the case of several hundred Jews in Hamburg as evidence. Both he and his son Cotton Mather recorded carefully miscellaneous information bearing on the Jews. In the 1740s, Jonathan Edwards counted among his hopeful events the baptism of a Jew celebrated for his great knowledge of the Hebrew and Chaldean languages. A few years later, he recorded with delight a report of 53 rabbis converting to Christianity. In the late 18th century, Ezra Stiles was so concerned about the matter that he drove himself to establish friendly relations with the Jews in Newport, Rhode Island, where he was a minister in the years before he assumed the presidency of Yale College. At Yale, he fostered instruction in the Hebrew language. All of these ministers and many more like them shared the assumption that the image of Israel was the informing metaphor for the church in America. Old Israel, New Israel was a link they established easily. The story of ancient Israel was the prefigurement for them of the life of the believers in America. Thus, their concern for the final conversion of the Jews mirrored indirectly concern with their own situation. For the early Mormons, the millennial age was the climax of the apocalyptic scheme and a topic of great attention in the Star. Although a millennium is a period of 1,000 years, in the 1830s, not all commentators presumed that the millennial age was to be a literal 1,000 years. Though the millennium was to come near the end of time, precisely when it would begin was hotly debated. Although the millennium was always depicted as an earthly experience, by contrast with a heavenly existence, there was considerable discussion about where on the earth the millennium would be located or centered. Though the millennial age was to be a period of peace and prosperity for the saints, the precise nature of the conditions during that time was open to speculation. The Star addressed all of these issues at one time or another, sporadically under the editorship of Phelps, but in a more sustained and sophisticated fashion under Cowdery. Some of the earliest millennial speculation in the Evening and Morning Star was contained in the hymns printed on its pages. Each of the first three issues in 1832 had a section entitled Hymns Selected and Prepared for the Church of Christ in These Last Days. Subsequent issues also had space reserved for hymns. One example I think will suffice. The Pilgrim's Hymn opens in the following manner. Go on, dear pilgrims, while below, in wisdom's path of peace, determined nothing else to know but Jesus' righteousness. The hymn has 12 stanzas in which life is described as a journey toward a promised land. There, it continues, we shall be when Christ appears, and all his glory see, and reign with him 1,000 years, when all the world is free. The hymn writer concludes, when we've been there 1,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. The informing image throughout all these stanzas is the millennial age. Elsewhere, the Star discussed the millennium under such related topics as the New Jerusalem, the first resurrection, which is that of the saints preceding the millennial age, by contrast with the second resurrection, which is that of the rest of mankind, which precedes the final judgment, and the topic of the coming of Christ. The most extended reflection on the millennial age in the Star is an 8-part essay entitled simply Millennium. This piece is both an attack upon the views of other authors and a defense of the biblical basis of the Mormon view of the millennium. The principal target of attack is Alexander Campbell, editor of the Millennial Harbinger, another religious periodical, and a leader of the Disciples movement. According to the early Mormons, the basis for all belief in the 1,000-year reign of Christ is biblical prophecy, which has not yet been fulfilled. On this ground, said the Star, it is clear that before the millennium arrives, an age of great apostasy will occur, during which the religions of the world will forsake the true God, their weakness and folly becoming very apparent. Having wandered far from Christ, the world will be in a deplorable condition. In these times, religion will divide into numerous parties and sects. False teachers will arise who will not be able to discern truth because of the gross darkness. They will have a form of godliness, but deny the power thereof. Though these people in the last days will consider themselves enlightened, very learned, exceedingly polite, and remarkably genteel, in reality and in the eyes of God and those inspired of God, they are as, and I'm quoting, natural brute beasts. During these days, an abundance of signs of the times will be manifest, warning the evil ones and comforting the saints in their distress. These evil circumstances will be overturned when the millennial age begins. The millennium will be inaugurated by the physical return of Christ in the clouds, a return which will cause the wicked to wail, but the saints to rejoice. The coming of Christ will be preceded by the gathering of the saints in two places, the Jews in Jerusalem and the Gentiles in Zion on this continent. When Christ returns, those of the faithful who are dead and who have been martyred for Christ will be raised, that's the first resurrection, and will join in the rule of 1,000 years. The period that follows then is the most marvelous in all human history. The millennium is a time of peace and rest, of goodness and prosperity, but it is more too. During the millennium, God's ultimate plan is fulfilled and his designs vindicated. Evil is conquered, and the saints are rewarded for their labors. The earth is renewed during this period of rest, and the gospel restored to its proper place as the kingdom of God prevails over all. As with the signs of the times and the conversion of the Jews, so too with the topic of the millennial age. The early Mormons were drawn to speculation in several ways. Again, the influence of the prophet was strong upon his followers. First in the Book of Mormon and then during the earliest stage of the movement, while still in New York, Smith had offered judgments concerning eschatological issues, including the millennium. His comments were generally brief and lacking the explicit quality so many of his later revelations possessed. In subsequent years, his public statements showed the same guarded quality. Smith thus opened the agenda, and the Star carried on the discussion. The discourse in the Star drew heavily upon earlier American speculation concerning the millennium. Few religious issues had stirred greater intensity in America. The variety of opinions seemed almost infinite. Some apocalyptic commentators were unwilling to offer chronological calculations about the beginning of the 1,000 years. John Cotton, for example, thought the millennium simply referred to the time of renewed activity in the church after the fall of the papacy. His was not a personal reign of Christ. Others offered bolder predictions, sometimes once, sometimes twice, and sometimes three or more times. A Cotton Mather, as a case in point, was consumed with matters of apocalyptic numerology. He overcame the last twinge of compunction and set the date 1697 for the fall of Antichrist, which he thought would signal the beginning of the millennium. When that day came and went, he read some more and recalculated, this time for 1716 and 1717. His excitement rose again, only to be dashed again. His third calculation was for 1736, a date he didn't live to see. In the 19th century, William Miller of the Millerite Party was given only two chances, and then his Adventist movement was discredited, which contributed to the growing disfavor toward eschatology in our culture. Most commentators were more cautious than Cotton Mather and William Miller. Jonathan Edwards, for example, identified only an approximate position on the divine timetable. There was also fierce debate about the location of the millennium. In the 1640s, one prominent English commentator had suggested Palestine would be the center of the millennium. America, by contrast, Joseph Meade wrote, was the seat of Gog and Magog, the apocalyptic beasts. Increased Mather resented this latter association, and with his son Cotton moved toward the notion that America was likely to be involved in the millennial age, in a positive way, obviously. Someday the howling wilderness of America would blossom and become the garden of God. Some commentators could not make up their minds. As a young man, Jonathan Edwards thought the evidence pointed to Palestine, for it was conveniently situated in the midst of three continents, with easy access for many by water. In 1742, during the euphoria of the Great Awakening, he changed his mind, offering his now famous judgment concerning the millennium. He wrote, "And there are many things that make it probable that this work, referring to the millennium, will begin in America." A few years later, when the awakening had ebbed, he acknowledged with regret that his hopes had been too high, and the debate went on. All agreed that the millennium would be a time of success for the gospel, but whether Christ would be present physically or only spiritually, whether his return to earth would inaugurate the 1,000 years or terminate it, on these points the commentators differed. For example, Charles Grandison Finney, writing in the late 1820s in New York, said that if Christians were united all over the world, the millennium might be brought about in 3 months. Obviously, his millennium is very different from that of the Mormons. As the 19th century progressed, positions hardened, and the millennialists were classified as pre or post, depending on the position of Christ's return in their scheme. The early Mormon views articulated in the Star are not clear on all of these issues and do not classify easily. What is clear, however, is that if the Mormons had not been interested in the millennium, they would have been a highly exceptional religious community. So far, we've attempted two things: the recovery of a sense of the centrality of apocalyptic discourse among the early Mormons, and the description and historical placement of the viewpoint expressed in the Star. The third and final task is analysis. I want to identify several theological functions fulfilled by the apocalyptic reflections of the early Mormons. In doing so, I should warn you that I'm moving back toward the question with which I began this presentation, namely, whether the decline of apocalyptic in the Mormon Church has been an advantage or a disadvantage for the Latter-day Saints. Before proceeding, let's remind ourselves about the situation of the Mormon Church at the time when the first issue of the Star was published. By June of 1832, the restored Church of Christ had been in existence under Smith's leadership for only 2 years.
The Book of Mormon had first appeared in Palmyra on March 26, 1830. Although the church was growing rapidly, only 2 years before it had consisted of a mere handful of followers. It has been estimated that by the summer of 1831, approximately 1,000 had joined the movement. That success actually brought new problems. The ecclesiastical structure of the church had to be shaped during these years. During these same years, the church began experimenting with a plan for sharing property and resources, a plan which quickly revealed certain flaws. Every place they went, whether New York, Ohio, Missouri, or elsewhere, the Mormons were receiving a mixed response. Enthusiasm from those who were persuaded by the prophet and his followers, rejection, ridicule, and violent opposition by the many more who were not persuaded. Precisely at this moment, when the infant church was trying to establish itself, the Evening and the Morning Star came along and dispensed a heavy dose of apocalyptic discourse to its readers. During these early years, the leaders of the church utilized every resource at their disposal to meet the varied needs of the growing community. The prophet in particular used the power of continuing revelation. The editors of the Star, who did not possess anything equivalent to that, and who in fact had been rebuked at one time or another by the prophet, used the printed word. The apocalyptic message they proclaimed provided the readers of the Star with a set of powerful symbols that could be used in a variety of ways. The apocalyptic discourse of the early Mormons was particularly advantageous in recruiting new members for the community. When symbols are rich in content and connotation and readily accessible to many, the communication of ideas is facilitated. The editors of the Star were speaking a language familiar to the people of their day. One student of early Mormon history has written, quote, that in no other period in American history were the last days felt to be so imminent as between 1820 and 1845. Never again would the cultural climate be so receptive to an apocalyptic message. The early missionaries found the discourse of the Star highly useful in their labors. In the early 19th century, apocalyptic discourse was not an embarrassment, but an advantage. Apocalyptic discourse was also an effective means for affirming the religious position of the Mormon Church. In 1832, the theological claims of the Latter-day Saints were not as startling as they would become in subsequent years. However, the apocalyptic mode was still highly congenial for reflecting the sense of urgency the Mormons felt about the times in which they lived, their condemnation of the established and the competing religious communities, their confidence concerning the future of the restored gospel, and their notion of the specialness of America as the site for the gathering of Zion. Mormon reflection on the signs of the times, on the conversion of the Jews, and on the nature of the millennium, therefore, was not idle pastime. It was, to use the phrase of William Phelps, designed for the edification and benefit of the soul, to obtain a glorious resurrection, to promote the gathering of Israel, and for godliness. In other words, the speculation of the Star about apocalyptic issues was serious theological business. The apocalyptic discourse of the early Mormons was also a powerful weapon for use against the opponents of the church. By its very nature, apocalyptic tends to divide sharply the forces of good from the forces of evil. Joseph Smith provided the line of distinction between the two: acceptance of the prophet and his revelations, or rejection of the full gospel. The Star depicted this conflict in stark terms. The battle was on. The struggle was earth-shaking. Apocalyptic discourse was highly congenial to this conflict mentality. Listen to a portion of a letter from Joseph Smith to Oliver Cowdery, which was printed in the last issue of the Star. The prophet was speaking about the challenge of Alexander Campbell's views on the Restoration. Smith wrote, and I'm quoting, "I have always had the satisfaction of seeing the truth triumph over error and darkness give way before light, when such men were provoked to expose the corruption of their own hearts by crying delusion, deception, and false prophets accusing the innocent and condemning the guiltless, and exalting themselves to the stations of gods to lead blindfold men to perdition. In an apocalyptic struggle, no holds are barred. For the early Mormons, the high level of rhetoric in apocalyptic discourse was appropriate because in their minds, the stakes involved in the conflict were equally high. The use of apocalyptic became a way for the early Mormons to reinforce their sense of identity as a chosen people. Apocalyptic is cosmic in scope, involving judgments about all of time and all of history. The star gave voice to the belief that the Latter-day Saints were selected by God to bring the fullness of the gospel to the world at the end of time. They were a special people with unique responsibilities. They had been singled out as witnesses to the great doings of the Lord, quote, in these last days, as agents to assist in bringing forth his everlasting covenant for the gathering of his elect. The Mormons were not living in ordinary times, according to their viewpoint, nor were they an ordinary people. And finally, the use of apocalyptic was a means of encouraging the saints in the face of hardship. No doubt this was one of the most appealing features in the message of the star for the early Mormons. Its ultimate promise, that is, apocalyptic's ultimate promise, is very clear. Good will triumph over evil. The forces of truth will defeat the forces of darkness. No matter how distressed the situation may be, the glorious day approaches soon when godliness will prevail and the faithful will enjoy a moment of peace and rest. These were the tidings of great joy that Phelps trumpeted in the prospectus printed in the first issue of the Star. On this eschatological point, the Latter-day Saints have never wavered. But the times have changed since 1830, and the church has changed too. The eschatological message of the Latter-day Saints, while still powerful and evocative, is less apocalyptic. It is more refined and subdued, and the end times have not come. In fact, the latter days seem farther away than ever, even for the Latter-day Saints, or maybe especially for the Latter-day Saints. Thank you.
years ago, about this time, I was sitting in a Protestant chapel down in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, just recently completed Harvard's chaplain school, and had my first assignment at an Army base as a chaplain representing the Protestants in that particular area. About the second day, another young chaplain came to my office and introduced himself as of the Presbyterian persuasion and said, "I understand you're a Mormon." I said, "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Well, I've been wanting to meet an informed Mormon for a long time because I've got a question I want an answer to." He said, "Are you a premillenarian or postmillenarian?" And I kind of shook my head. I thought he was talking about ladies' hats, to tell the truth. And I resolved then that I was going to find out what our position was in regards to the millennium, and I've made a fairly careful study of that for many years. And so I'm very grateful to Professor Stein for his paper that has presented quite a clear view, a very clear view, in fact, of the early Mormon apocalypticism and their concepts of the millennium. And I want to congratulate him for catching the spirit and meaning of this early Mormon theology in regards to our eschatology. I agree with his statement that Mormons are heirs to a theological tradition that has been preoccupied with matters of eschatology, and that, quote, Mormonism is inescapably eschatological and apocalyptic. And what I liked even better was that he defined those terms for us. I think that is sometimes a pretty helpful thing in meetings such as this, that eschatology is simply the doctrine of the last days. It is based on the concept that there is a two-age view of history, this present evil age that will finally come to an end and be succeeded by the golden age that we talk of as the millennium. That's eschatology. Apocalypticism, as he said, is revealing that which is hidden or uncovering something that is secret. And generally speaking, it refers to documents that purport to know something about what is going to happen in the future, and especially in regards to eschatological doctrine. And, of course, millennium simply refers to 1,000. But as Professor Stein has shown in his paper, people have not always stuck to just the literal idea of 1,000 years. His choice of articles and points of view expressed in the Evening and Morning Morning Star, I think, is an excellent choice. And he said he did it to recover a recognition of the centrality of the apocalyptic message in early Mormonism. This is an excellent one. I became very much aware of this when one of my master's students, Lou Reinwand, who wrote a fine master's thesis on Mormon millennialism, pointed out the fact that, he put it this way, that the star was by far the most effective millennial harbinger of the early church, and credited W.W. Phelps with having a profound influence on the development of the theology of the church in this period. I think that's true, and I think we need a lot more study about such people, especially about Phelps. And I expect somebody will come up afterwards and tell me there's been a fine one written that I'm not aware of. But in any case, we need them. I was interested in his citing Phelps publishing the Pilgrim's Hymn, and especially this last verse that I have come to associate with the Favorite Baptist hymn, Amazing Grace. It's been popularized in recent years. One of these chaplains that I knew back at Harvard Chaplain School, a Baptist minister, Jim Franklin, asked me if I knew the words to Amazing Grace. I said I'd never heard of it. He says, you can't be a Christian unless you know Amazing Grace. And so I asked him to teach it to me, and so I've kind of remembered it. But this last verse, as printed in Phelps' Morning and Evening Star, said, when we've been there 1,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. I noticed in the copies I've had of the Baptist, they say, when we've been there 10,000 years, when we've been dead 10,000 years. A little change, and maybe it reflects that they've kind of changed it as far as the implications of the millennium is concerned. But I think it's clear, as Professor Stein has said, that if the Mormons had not been interested in the millennium, they would have been a highly exceptional religious community in the 19th century. Then Professor Stein has given us a fine historical background of some of the apocalypticism of New England and of other groups, and then has pointed out the advantages that this apocalypticism gave to the early Mormon church. First of all, as he pointed out, many people were looking for the second coming. And in the early 19th century, apocalyptic discourse was not an embarrassment, but an advantage. Secondly, he said it affirmed the religious position of the Mormon church. It justified their sense of urgency. The condemnation of existing religious communities, the confidence they had concerning the future of the restored gospel, and the special role of America as a site for the gathering of Zion, and their concern with the signs of the times, the conversion of the Jews, and as he pointed out to some extent, the concern with the Indians, and of course could well be tied to the gathering of Israel and the role they would play in the last days. It was also a powerful weapon against opponents, forces of good against the force of evil in this last great battle. Concept of a chosen people selected by God to bring the fullness of the gospel to the world at the end of time. And so, as he said, the Mormons were not living in ordinary time, nor were they ordinary people. Such concepts enabled them to face incredible hardships and make unusual sacrifices, because the ultimate promise is very clear. And that promise is this: good will triumph over evil, the forces of truth will defeat the forces of darkness. No matter how distressed the situation may be, the glorious day approaches soon when godliness will prevail and the faithful will enjoy a moment of rest and peace. These were the tidings of great joy that Phelps trumpeted in the prospectus printed in the first issue of the Star. On this eschatological point, the Latter-day Saints have never wavered. Professor Stein raises a basic question in his paper at the near the beginning and then returns to it at the end. It's this: does the loss or blunting of a radical apocalyptic edge come as an advantage or a disadvantage for a religious community whose self-identification for over a century and a half, 150 years, has been Latter-day Saints? He does not answer this question. And I kind of hope he would tell us that. But I would like to suggest, it seems to me he's suggesting that while apocalypticism was respectable in the 19th century, it's been an embarrassment in the 20th century. And you remember his definition by Walter Rauschenbusch that eschatology is usually loved in inverse proportion to the square of the mental diameter of those doing the loving, which, if I read it right, is kind of a derogatory remark about anybody that is concerned about eschatology. Some of you will remember in Klaus Hansen's Quest for Empire, in the epilogue, he tells of a Bishop Homer Tomlinson, not a Mormon bishop, founder of the theological political party in America and running for presidency in 1960, was on the Princeton campus and announced that the kingdom of God was at hand and about to be ushered in. And he had thousands of students applauding him, but come to find out it was all in ridicule. And that they printed his picture on the paper the next day and paraded him around the campus and had a big time, just like they were having some kind of a buffoon, an ignoramus, had come to entertain them. Well, this is Klaus Hansen, after relating that, said Mormonism was spared such a fate because they moved away from millennialism. And as Professor Stein has suggested, it has become refined and blunted. We have moved to respond to the values of the 20th century. In his last paragraph, I find the only thing that I really disagree with in Professor Stein's paper. He says, "But times have changed since the 1830s, and the church has changed too. The eschatological message of the Latter-day Saints, while still powerful and evocative, is less apocalyptic. It is more refined and subdued." And I don't disagree with that. I think that's right. "And the end times have not come. In fact, the latter days seem further away than ever, even for the Latter-day Saints, or maybe especially for the Latter-day Saints." Now, that's the one I wonder about. As I've suggested, our eschatology may be more refined and subdued, but most Mormons are far from being embarrassed about their apocalypticism and millennialism, and do not seem at all embarrassed with the title Latter-day Saint, despite the fact that the latter days have now stretched into 150 years. "Every president of the church has reaffirmed that these are the latter days, and several have predicted that the millennium would begin in their own lifetime. Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and Lorenzo Snow as notable examples." I've got a quote here from Lorenzo Snow that might be of interest to you. He was preaching tithing and the need to get on the tithing records, and said that if the saints will properly accept and carry out this law, then in 15 or 20 years, and this is 1899 when he made this statement, 15, 20 years, perhaps much less, they will consecrate and return to Jackson County to build the beautiful city and temple. The obstacles in the way, apparently so great, will all be removed, if need be, by earthquake, cyclone, and devouring fire." And so that was his concept. In our own time, Numerous general authorities, including President Kimball, have asserted that we are living in the Saturday night of time. President Benson's address to the BYU students last February asserted that, quote, they were part of a generation which might well witness the return of our Lord. I've had, over the past few years, several graduate students and senior seminar students go to work on different aspects of millennialism. I had one trace and see what evidence there was that it's still a vital factor and being preached and expected in our own time. He found that the Church News editorialized in 1966 the current events that signify the near approach of Christ's coming. That in 1968 the Church News published in its quotable quotes section a series of eschatological statements made by all the presidents of the Church up to David O. McKay, and was entitled "The Great Millennium Shall Come and Christ Will Reign 1,000 Years." Point out one who gave an address in conference that used the Doctrine and Covenants, section 77, to justify the belief that the second coming would be about the year 2000. And this is, I find, quite a widespread belief that, based on Archbishop Usher's chronology, that Adam was 4,000, and to make it seem more scientific, I guess, 4,004 years before Christ, and that we are approaching 2,000 years since that time. And this Doctrine and Covenants section talks about the seven periods of time, the 7,000 years. And so as we approach the year 2000, according to this chronological setup, we've finished 6,000 years and are entering into the Sabbath day of God's creation, or the 7,000 year, which should be a time of peace. And this was given in conference in April of 1967. I found further support for this. I had a student survey a few different wards, one in Portland, Oregon, one in Los Angeles, one in Rupert, Idaho, and one in one of the BYU states, to see how they regarded the millennium, and asked them whether they thought we were premillennialist, postmillennialist, or amillennialist, and what period of time did they figure that would come most likely. And most of them couldn't figure out whether we were pre or post, which shows their intelligence, because I think nobody knows. As a matter of fact, we're a little of both, and some quite a few other things too. We have never been very clear in this definition of our stand on the millennium, and not at all consistent. But the thing that impressed me was that in the period, he made 10-year periods, and in the period from 1995 to 2005, by all odds, most of the people felt that that's when Christ would return again, and that's centering around that year 2000. I did get some changed reaction from my high priest quorum, about 65 of them in the class. I asked them how many expected to live to see the second coming in their lifetime, and only one raised his hand. Of course, they're all pretty well along in years, and not all prime candidates for the celestial kingdom, but I was a little surprised at that. Well, I'll bring this right to a close. I know you've been here a long time. As you know, the signs of the time are very impressive right now. Even a skeptic has got to admit that the Jews have gathered to Jerusalem, that there's plenty of evil in the world, more than we've ever thought could exist. And for the first time in the history of mankind, we can see how the earth could be destroyed by fire. It's there. And people are talking that way, at least in some of the groups that I've moved in. One of these papers that a student wrote, and a very good one, he called our millennialism flexible millennialism. And he's serious. But he said it was that we shifted from a time to a place, and that we shifted back and forth between postmillennialism and premillennialism. Another one that I had done just this summer, just finished, he called it, Seminole Saints versus Sesquicentennial Saints, and found that the early saints regard the millennium quite differently than we're hearing now. That they, for them, it was pretty much a matter of the good and the bad, and only us good ones would get caught up in the air, the rest would be destroyed, and then the millennial reign would be ushered in, and there's no bad ones, so you don't have to do missionary work or anything else. You just sing God's praises, as the hymn said. He's found in the Sesquicentennial Saints that in the book printed by the church, Gospel Principles, it states that the question was asked, what will we be doing during the millennial reign? And the answer was, we'll be doing temple work and missionary work. And it looks to me like we've got some pretty hard choices there. Either sit around singing praises or else I hope there's a little wider variety in that. I am concerned. I really am, though, that as we approach the year 2000, and as the signs become more ominous, and they're bound to become more ominous. In fact, I hope they just stay signs and not the actuality. As they become more ominous, I think we're going to have an increased emphasis on millennial predictions and warnings. And if, as it might happen, on the morning of January the 1st, in the year 2000, and as I think it will happen, that the newspaper will be delivered to the door, and that the 21st century version of Good Morning America will be on, I think our flexible millennialism will find an answer. Thank you.
Those three choices are almost sufficient enticement for me to want to stay wicked and do my part to postpone the millennium. It's actually coincidental, I suspect, that this session dealing with Mormon millennial thought was the last one our eschatological contribution, but actually the millennium of the Sunstone Symposium will be the dinner, the golden part, and it's going to be in the Hotel Utah, starts at 7:30 in the Lafayette Ballroom. We certainly thank Professor Stein and Professor Campbell for their reviews of this important part of Mormon thought. We're very grateful for this great treatment of the star and the ramifications of Mormon millennial thought. I think that, in summary, I could say that I have been very, very much impressed during this two-day symposium at the wisdom and the research and creative efforts of our Mormon scholars, and equally impressed, if not more than that, of the ability of our Gentile friends to maintain an interest in Mormonism, to treat it seriously, to give us the benefits of the doubt where that's required, and even further, the fact that they have been able to come to rather perceptive understandings of our beliefs and contribute much to us. To me, I've learned that we can learn a great deal from each other as Mormon people by exchanging ideals in a format such as this. We have much to learn from other people, such as our friends that we have invited in to talk to us. And probably we need to do a great deal more in trying to imitate them and being understanding of their positions. I suspect that Mormons are very weak and vulnerable in that we know really and understand very little of the non-Mormon world. And I think to the extent that we have that weakness, we are ineffective in communicating with the majority of the people on the earth. We thank all of you as audience for coming. The staff for helping, our sponsors, our speakers, for all of your efforts. We are extremely grateful. And we announced last year that this would be an annual event. So far, Our predictions have been true. Of course, they haven't extended for very long down the timeline. And if there's a third symposium, all of you will be notified in the mail, I'm sure. So thank you, and we'll see some of you at the dinner. And for the rest, we appreciate your being here.